Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Please join me welcoming Phyllis Schlafly.
They say that women are like tea bags. You don't know their strength until they get into hot water.
We need to talk about the threat of the women's liberation movement. So let me be clear. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. What I am against is a small elitist group putting down homemakers. They want to create a sex-neutral society, which will mean that women are going to find themselves with two full-time jobs. So you need to tell your senators you want them to vote no on this Equal Rights Amendment so we can have a country that we are proud to leave our daughters.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Still Watching Mrs. America. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you were just joining us for the first time on a Still Watching podcast, what Richard and I like to do is pick a television show that we are currently watching closely, obsessing over, and sort of discuss it in minute detail on a week-by-week basis. We have opted to overlap right now our coverage of the HBO series Westworld with the FX on Hulu series Mrs. America, just because we were so excited about Mrs. America and we couldn't wait. We didn't want it to pass us by. So here we are to talk about this great new show. Richard, what has piqued your interest the most about this series, Mrs. America?
Well, I mean, I think the cast primarily is really exciting. You know, we're getting Kate Blanchett playing Phyllis Schlafly. I believe this is Blanchett's first real foray on television in at least, you know, her kind of movie star era of her career. So that's kind of, you know, many other great actors have done that before her. And so she's the kind of finally taken the cue. So that's interesting. You know, it's easy to get excited about her. It's less easy for me to get excited about a show about Phyllis Schlafly, who, I mean, I'll make no bones about it. To my mind, was sort of a monster. You know, I think from what we've seen, these three episodes that we've seen so far, the portrayal of Schlafly, who is certainly an influential person, is even-handed, let's say. And then, you know, all the other cast members as well are very exciting.
We're really excited for this series. So we are covering on this episode of Still Watching, we are covering the first three episodes, which dropped all at once, this Wednesday. They are titled Phyllis, Gloria, and Shirley. And as you can tell by the episode titles, each episode is somewhat centered on, a different participant of the women's movement. So we are going to be talking about those three episodes together. That's a lot to cover in one podcast episode. We also have three great interviews on this podcast that we're really excited about. We have the amazing Cate Blanchett. We have the amazing Uzo Aduba. And we have the amazing Dobby Waller, who created the show. So we've got three interviews. So that's also a lot to get through in one podcast. So Richard and I are going to keep our discussion of the show itself a little brief this week, just to make room for all those great interviews we have that we're so thrilled to bring to you. And we promise that we will go a little bit more in depth in the upcoming weeks, but this is just going to serve as sort of a broad introduction to the series, our you know, first takes, try to contextualize the whole subject matter a bit for you all, and then let the women of the series speak for themselves when it comes to what these first three episodes have to give to you. So Richard, if people have any thoughts or feelings, or if you and I, heaven forbid, get anything wrong about the second wave feminist movement, which I am very likely to do, where can they reach us? Where can our listeners give us feedback?
Joe wrote this, just on Twitter. No. They can reach us at stillwatching at gmail.com. I think for this show in particular, you know, on our Westworld series, we get a lot of fan theories, which is fun, but I think on this show, it's going to be more about, like you said, historical accuracy. It's going to be about this discourse. I mean, I just called the subject of the show, one of the subjects of the show, a monster. Maybe you disagree. I don't know. So I think that, like, hopefully we can have a lively exchange, in, you know, podcast to listener form, over email, and, you know, obviously we'll address, things on the show. And, yeah, I hope people engage, because this is a show all about engagement.
Yeah, so please do email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And I, full disclosure, Richard, before we started this series, I hope it's okay for me to share this. Richard was like, are we sure anyone wants to listen to me talk about this show, created by a woman, starring a bunch of great women, about the feminist movement? I do want to hear Richard talk about the show. I love talking to Richard about all manner of television. So, but it is our hope also that we might have some of our other, Vanity Fair colleagues on future episodes as well. But I'm really excited to talk to Richard about the show, which I was interested from from a historical perspective, but then also found myself just getting really emotionally invested, in everything that this show is covering. One thing we should say before we get started, we're going to dive into the cast of characters that we have here, but, I want to mention, just to get us all on the same page, that, Dobby Waller, who created the series, and who gave us a great interview for this episode. She has a long history in television that goes through Desperate Housewives, Mad Men, Halt and Catch Fire, and Here We Are. And I, you know, there's a great interview with her and our colleague Joy Press up on VanityFair.com. Knowing that that's where Dobby came from really helped me contextualize what I was watching, if that makes sense. And I love that this is the project that she decided to sink her teeth into. So let us get started. This series covers basically a decade, in the history of the women's movement from 1971 to 1981. And, for context, I was born in 1981. So, it was really interesting to me to see the political sort of stew that was cooking right before I was born. It just really helped me understand what I was born into, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. In a way that I hadn't before. But let us start with the people. Basically, this is a fight between two factions over the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, and the effort to get it ratified in enough states so that it could be added to the Constitution. And so we've got two sides of this argument, right? We've got the feminists and whatever we want to call Phyllis Schlafly's side of the argument. So let's start with the feminists. And what I love about this show is that these feminists are shown absolutely warts and all, and clashing with each other, which is exactly as it should be in any movement. There's always some kind of, interior, disagreement and discussion. But let's start with possibly the most famous, even more famous than Phyllis Schlafly, who is, you know, ostensibly sort of the linchpin of the series. The most famous, I think, feminist figure to come out of this time is Gloria Steinem, played by the great Rose Byrne. Gloria Steinem founded Ms. Magazine, as we, you know, see in her centric episode. Richard, what do you make of both Gloria Steinem as a figure that you're aware of in the culture and how she's depicted here in these first three episodes?
I think that they handle her in an interesting way because she's not depicted as an outright hero. I think you see that in especially the third episode, which focuses on Shirley Chisholm, where, you know, I think, you know, she was complicated. She understood certain or believed she understood certain kind of compromises that had to be made. But she obviously was a force for positive change in this country and in the world. And one that, you know, was embraced in by the kind of zeitgeist, by popular culture. Many people, you know, say it's because of her looks. I mean, that is a topic that is addressed in the show. And, you know, and I think she's a complicated public figure. And the show thus far has done a good job of showing, you know, those various facets of that complexity. I think Byrne is great. You know, this show benefits, considerably, for me and other, you know, perhaps other people who were at the Sundance Film Festival this year, because there was another, project there that was about Gloria Steinem called The Glorias, directed by Julie Taymor, featuring, Alicia Vikander and Julianne Moore as Steinem at two different ages. And it is, by my mind, a kind of a mess of a movie. So it's nice to see, someone else get this right and this figure right, because she's fascinating.
I am a huge, I think we're both huge Rose Byrne fans.
Yeah.
And, the last time that, she was on a show in like a long, meaningful manner was the TV show Damages, which is an old favorite of mine. So I'm thrilled to see her, you know, back on TV, on a week in, week out basis. And she has, I think, the biggest challenge, in one regard out of any of the performers here in that Gloria Steinem is the figure we're probably all of us, the general audience, most familiar with. There's a lot of, you know, known women in this series, but Gloria Steinem is still someone we see on our TVs and stuff like that. So, you know, a peek behind the curtain at a future episode of Still Watching, we'll have a conversation with Rose Byrne, all about that and about, her incredible Gloria Steinem wig, as well. Okay. So then next we have, Bella Abzug, who had the fun nickname of Battling Bella. This is played by the great, Margot Martindale, character actress Margot Martindale, as Bojack Horseman calls her. She was a U.S. representative for 6 years, and a founder of this movement. I have to say, Bella is maybe my favorite character in this entire series because I know so many women. I'm like acquainted with several staunch feminists who remind me so much of her. So it is like really, exciting for me to see, this kind of character portrayed on screen. What do you make of Bella and Marco's, portrayal of her, Richard?
Yeah, no, she's somewhat familiar to me as someone who grew up, my dad was a college professor and I just knew a lot of, academic women in his sphere who, had a sort of similar disposition but, you know, roughly a little bit younger than Abzug was, when I was a kid, but, yeah, very familiar. And I also, like with Steinem, I like that they show a complexity with her.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, you see Shirley Chisholm kind of butting heads with her about, you know, and actually I think it is reflective of the way that our discourse about the current presidential campaign is happening. Like, is Biden, you know, or I guess Sanders has dropped out now, so it's kind of a moot point, but, you know, is Biden's brand of like palatable centrism the more effective way to get something done versus just like being more radical? And I think that dialogue is something that has always, been a part of the progressive movement. And, so it's nice to see that kind of paid, thoughtful, credo, in this show and in the form of this character from, you know, played by one of my favorite actresses.
And that brings us to Shirley Chisholm, who is, you know, on, on my radar as the second most notable real life figure in this cast, played by the great Uzo Aduba, as I said, we will chat to in this episode of the podcast. Shirley was in the House of Representatives for 14 years, and she's the first Black candidate for a major party's nomination for president, the first woman to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, and the first woman to appear in a United States presidential debate. And, you know, we get a big taste of that in the third episode centered on Shirley. And, you know, she is someone that I think, was such a groundbreaking historical figure just generally, but, especially when I was made more aware of her, during the Obama administration. It was like, I felt like a lot of homage was paid to, you know, the road that she walked to make the Obama administration happen in the first place. So, and this idea, this question, exactly right, what you're saying, Richard, of like electability, who's electable. And it's incredible that we're having the same conversation, the exact same conversations, decades after, Shirley Chisholm was here. But for me, watching the first three episodes, I mean, I love the show. I'm all in right off the bat. But the moment where Shirley Chisholm takes the stage, at the convention at the end of episode three, and you see the women in the audience who have both supported her and let her down in many ways, feel emotional to see her up there. That's the moment watching the show that I was like, this show is going to be just emotionally really impactful for me. So how did the Shirley of it all land for you, Richard?
Yeah, I think it's the strongest episode, in certain ways. Well, I mean, partly because Aduba is so good. It's so nice to see her doing something that isn't, Orange is the New Black, which she was great on, but like that character was such a big sort of idiosyncratic character that, it's nice to see her playing someone who is, you know, feels a bit, frankly, realer. And yeah, I think it just resonates. It's one of the storyline is one that resonates really with today's, you know, climate. I mean, a lot of this does, but, you know, about these questions of intersectionality and people, who are, you know, the first blank to do blank, often feeling like, well, I'm also want to do the thing. This is not just a symbolic gesture, you know? And I think seeing Chisholm's frustration with exactly that, is really powerful and a worthy reminder that the dialogues we're having, and we constantly talk about, this current era being so, you know, heightened social justice and, you know, a woke and all these things, which, you know, are now sort of wielded as criticisms by a large number of people in this country. This same kind of discussion was happening nearly 50 years ago, you know, and probably longer than that. So, I think the Shirley episode in particular is a kind of bracing reminder of that fact.
So the first two episodes, Phyllis and Gloria, written by Dobby Weller, directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. And then the third episode, this episode about Shirley Chisholm, is written by Tanya Barfield and directed by Alma Asante, to, you know, Black women. And, so I think something that I talked to Davi about and Uzo about is this idea when we talk about feminism in general, and absolutely when we talk about second wave feminism, this question of intersectionality, which is a term we use now, but was not maybe a term, or I think definitely wasn't a term that was used then, is a big question. How did the women's movement embrace you know, women of color and gay women, and how did it let them down? And I think that that's a really, important episode and, really, a really important one to have in this first chunk of episodes that we get all at once. So why don't we not waste any time and go to our interview, with Uzo Aduba, who played, Shirley Chisholm. Start by asking you, you know, this project has been in the works since, you know, before the last presidential election. It's been a long time in the works, and I'm wondering when it first came across your desk.
Not last year, fall of the year previous, so 2018.
And what did you make of the project? What was your first reaction?
Well, I was excited for two reasons. One, I was excited because, A, I didn't think I would work with another group of, like, all-female cast that was really talented on something, like, Substitute. So that was, like, really exciting, because I definitely, when we were finishing Orange, I was thinking this is something that's probably never going to happen again, Uzo, so really enjoy it. Seriously, I remember saying it, like, so dramatically, and then it was like, check your inbox, and I was like, oh, this could happen again. And then the second thing was, I just thought it was really cool that there were all these women, some of whom I had never heard of, for sure, that were getting their time, their space to really hold space and for their stories to be more widely known. You know, I think I can speak for myself. I think I thought, when I think of the second wave feminist movement, there are, you know, some iconic figures, singular figures, and who have, you know, grown up to be gods, and you think that there's only these one or two or three people who, you know, participated in the movement, and then you realize, oh my gosh, there were so many people who were part of this. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just thought it was awesome that they, that those women, like, we speak their names. I thought that was pretty dope.
What were you aware of in terms of Shirley herself, and how much did you wind up learning about her in the process of playing her?
As a kid, I knew her just, like, as a name, because my mom really loved her. but I didn't know anything that she did. I was like, I like Shirley Chisholm, but I didn't actually know anything about her. I was just like, because my mom does, you know? Like, I just, like, you know? And then when I moved to New York, I had bought this book called An African American Century, and it was focused on 1900 to 1999, and all the pivotal, monumental African Americans who had held some level of impact or effect on the country or the world, and there was a section on Shirley Chisholm, and that was the first time I ever learned about her, and I learned that she was the first Black woman elected into Congress, and I learned she was the first woman and Black person to run for president, and learned what she sort of stood for and the impact she made, and that was, like, my beginnings of a Shirley Chisholm knowledge, and then I really got in more in-depth knowledge through this project, reading her books and learning about her life and hearing her voice, you know, her own words, and then the documentary and learning about her platform and seeing how, you know, frankly, how far ahead of the curve she was on a lot of issues that we talk about in even today's, you know, current election, that I thought was, yeah, it's pretty amazing. How ahead. She was a woman just, like, so far ahead of her time in so many ways, not just in terms of being a figure and trailblazer, but even just policy-wise. Some of the things that she spoke, you know, she spoke on LGBT issues in the 70s.
Right.
You know? Spoke up to Head Start. I was talking about universal health care then, the decriminalization of marijuana, and, you know, just a lot of issues that we talk about now and or have enacted, you know, just very, very powerful woman.
Yeah, I was really amazed watching episode 3 in particular, hearing so many things come out of Shirley's mouth in terms of the democratic process. They sound so similar to so many of the conversations we had around the last election and this election, the idea of the process itself being like unpenetrable. It's amazing. It's incredible to watch, you know?
Absolutely. And also really, you know, I thought it was powerful. You know, obviously we shot this before this primary, and it was written before the last election. I just thought how interesting, you know, just that cliche expression, you know, history repeats itself, but how often that is actually true when you're watching and experiencing the show. Because to your point, that what this woman is highlighting and spotlighting, you know, and then you flash forward some 50 years, and it's like, oh, we're doing this all again. We're doing this thing. We're doing it like literally almost to the letter again.
Yeah, the word electability I don't think is used in that episode, but it's like hanging over it the same way we talk about it now with, you know, candidates of color and female, right, and female candidates. And I'm wondering, you know, when you're playing a real life figure like this, how much in terms of your performance, how much do you want to calibrate it to, you know, there's footage of Shirley Chisholm giving speeches. There's, you know, we have a lot of record of her. How much do you want to make sure, you know, your speech pattern or your demeanor lines up with her? And how much is it important for you to find sort of an internal truth around the character?
The internal truth question was what I was drawn to. I focused on this question that I had, you know, I kind of go into my process often with asking a question, and I was really interested in this question of how does she define herself versus how the world has defined her and how the world sees her. To me, it became about capturing that obvious power and strength, and I don't mean that in the sense of, like, you know, her oration and, you know, just exclusively policy. I mean that in the sense of this is a person who is cut from an obviously different cloth, who, if in the late 60s, 70s, becomes politically activated as a woman, as a black woman in America, believes herself capable of taking on the seat of Congress, is elected for it, and then now believes, despite any woman or black person before her never having tried, that she possesses the ability to hold the highest office in the land. And I was interested in getting to the center of that voice.
Right.
Not the exterior. I was interested in getting to the center of that person because it resonated with me. This is, you know, a lot of her speeches, when you read them, it's about possibility, you know, hope. These are large pillars in her speeches at universities, and that idea of things being, the impossible being possible, resonated with me and was something I could connect with. The idea of how someone might view you, or what someone might think is possible for you versus what you think is possible for yourself.
Mm.
I was interested in that kernel of storytelling.
Just watching this whole project at home is very emotional to me, as a woman, like watching this movement, everything that came before my time. And speaking to various women who have appeared, they also found it extremely emotional. I'm wondering if you had a moment or a scene or a confrontation that was particularly challenging or emotional for you to film or to work on.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a bedroom scene that I have with my husband, played by the wonderful, amazing, and my friend Brandon Durden. We're talking about staying in and being supported, and she's saying how, why am I the only one who believes that a black woman, you know, she's talking about running for office, is possible. That it's a possible thing. Why am I the only one? And I was getting at in your last question.
Yeah.
I found that to be I didn't feel like Shirley was speaking just for herself. Let me say it that way.
Yeah.
And I know she wasn't. It was very emotional to me because it made me think back to growing up. My mom, you know, my family's from Nigeria, and my mom would say, I never knew there was anything wrong with being black until I moved to America. She would say that.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was anything wrong with it. And she's like, you would say, what do you mean? She'd be like, because in Nigeria, everyone is black. So your smartest person is black. Your dumbest person is black. Your president is black. Your teacher is black. The janitor is black. The poorest person in the country is black. And the richest one is black. You know what I mean? So I never understood knew there was anything wrong with being black until I came here and understood how people were seeing me. Or, you know, she'll tell stories. She would tell stories about moving to America. And by the way, I want to say that it was significant and made those scenes emotional because the time I'm referencing my mother saying these things and telling these stories are line up to when, you know, Shirley Chisholm is out in the world.
Right.
You know, this idea where she's saying, you know, there was a job she was applying, so I've been called in to teach at a very prestigious school, and she showed up and the secretary thought she was there for the custodial hiring that was happening on the other side of the school and sent my mom there, you know. Just the way that my mother felt she was viewed, the way I have felt myself viewed without any consideration of anything being maybe more for myself. And so I say this to say, it's like, I say all of that to say that scene in particular, along with the scene, the book signing scene with Bella and Betty and Gloria, really struck a nerve for me because I knew and was emotional to me because surely I was saying those words and she was saying them for herself, but she was saying it for someone. She was saying it, she wasn't the only one who felt that way. She was speaking for a larger group.
Yeah.
And that larger group she was speaking for includes me. And it was emotional because, you know, it's just that feeling of, you know, because of you, I am. Even though I'm not in politics, but your existence, whether you knew it or not, affected my life and the freedoms and experiences that I'm able to have.
In episode 3, there's the sequence where we see Phyllis Schlafly's movement sort of embrace racist members, racist language, that sort of stuff, as this, you know, sort of microcosm representation of the way in which the right wing has, you know, sheltered racists under their party umbrella in order to have the numbers that they need to get what they want to do. But how important is it also to show the way in which the left and the women's movement let down its black members, including Shirley, who's a founder of this wave of the women's movement?
That is a piece that has often been forgotten, and at least when we're, you know, really having the conversation about feminism and just party at large, right? It's a piece that, and it's an important piece that needs to be remembered. Again, you know, not to sound like a broken record, but or we dare to continue to repeat it.
Yeah.
I thought it was really strong, and I was glad that was included because it was important that the story, one, be wholly, hold everyone responsible who, you know, needed to be held responsible.
Right.
That needed to be held responsible. Two, I think it was also important because I think it really laid out the truth of the matter of that it wasn't just the racism that, and the say the right side argument and, you know, protesting that caused for this whole movement to fall apart. It wasn't set on a very solid foundation.
Right.
And to really kind of really put a little focus on the blind spot that lived within the Democratic Party, the women's liberation movement, that, you know, that it wasn't just the right that did it. We also bear some responsibility for having done it to ourselves and not seeing, well, the full range of possibility and strength that existed womanhood, you know? It wasn't a singular site for a single group. You know, I think that, I think it was very, I loved it. I thought it was great. Even, you know, there's that scene with Brianna when she says she wants to do an article on tokenism.
Yeah.
That really, really, I don't remember what episode it was, but forgive me, but I remember reading that and being like, like out loud, literally laughing out loud. Like, wow. How great.
Episode 3 was written by a black woman, directed by a black woman. What kind of difference does that make for you as a performer, you know, to have those two creative forces also on your episode?
I'll start here. Firstly, that Ama was the first, she is the second black woman director I've ever worked with in my life.
Wow.
And on film, excuse me. Let me not say that I have it in the theater, but on film. But it's not like there have been many in the theater, let me be clear. like, I don't want to make it sound like and I've done it 5,000 times on the film. No. It's still very scant, the number. Mm-hmm. But let me start with first saying that having them in the space, it was important. In that, firstly, it's important because they're not the only one. I don't know if you've ever felt like the only person of whatever the thing is that makes you the only one.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel great to sometimes be the only one. And it certainly doesn't feel great to be the only one, like going back to Brianna's scene where she's talking about the tokenism, where you're meant to, you know, black women not being a monolith and having to speak for an entire race, right? It doesn't feel good to be the only person and feel like you're representing an entire group of people when that's not how any other group might be made to bear a responsibility, right? So it was nice having that exist on our set at large. And then to go deeper with it, we had people come on our set, you know, day in, day out, because our producers were really, really and super, like, intense about having that, which I thought was awesome. But then on a deeper level, so rarely do you see black women in those particular chairs. And I'll go even a step further at the same time.
Right.
And them be women. It's not, oh, I can relate to you because I had that experience in this other format. They actually can relate to you because that exact same thing happened to them. And that becomes, when you're having, you know, discussions leading up to the work, the doing of the work before we're filming, we're sitting, we're talking, and Ama, who's just so generous in that way, and understands the balance that needs to be struck, it makes you feel like your thoughts, your perspective are in good hands, and that your perspective, at the very least, has been perhaps understood. You know that it's been wholly understood. Not that I don't think somebody else could not understand it, but I know for sure it's been understood.
One thing that I was, maybe it's completely naive of me, Richard, but one thing I was shocked to hear Uzo Dupo say to me is that Ama Sante is only the second woman of color to ever direct her in film or television. And
wow.
Like, when you think about Orange is the New Black, I'm astonished that's the case.
Really?
So,
yeah.
It's pretty upsetting, but, you know, great. Ama Sante did a great job with this. She's a great director generally, did a great job with this. And I think Bowden and Fleck did a great job with the first two episodes. I think, mm-hmm. like, you know, the directorially, this feels like, beautiful, elevated television, prestige television.
Yeah, I like the tone of the show. It's a little shaggy because it's the 70s and it's, you know, all that kind of thing. It has the picture has a nice grain to it, but it's also, you know, it's slick. I mean, these women are getting, you know, the big prestige TV treatment as they should. And, yeah, it's really well done. And I think it's also interesting seeing FX on Hulu, do one of these shows without the kind of Ryan Murphy imprimatur, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And I think they're doing very well with it.
All right. So let's run down the other, major players on this side of the debate. There's obviously more. We will get to them in future episodes, but let's just, get to the rest here, which is, Jill Ruckelshaus, who's played by Elizabeth Banks. She was the head of the White House Office of Women's Programs. And maybe most, you know, intriguingly for this conversation, was a Republican. And so this idea that the women's movement had, you know, the way she's presented in the show is she's like their token Republican. This idea that the movement is bipartisan. And which we should say, before Phyllis Schlafly came on the scene, you know, the ERA was an.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Incredibly popular, you know, position. It was a bipartisan, it had bipartisan support. And so the idea that Phyllis Schlafly made this sort of a divided topic is what we'll be watching unfold over these many episodes. But the figure of Jill being on, you know, among these other women, I think is really interesting, you know, comparison. I will say the Jill episode, which is coming down the line, is one of my favorite episodes of the whole season. So I'm really excited for us to get to that one. But Elizabeth Banks rocking an incredibly interesting wig as Jill. How are you feeling about this, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good hair work on the show.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, and I like, you know, I don't think I've watched as far into the series as you have. I like that each, I like the structure of the show where there's one character is sort of highlighted, but the other people don't disappear, you know?
Right.
So it's just kind of fun seeing, you know, Banks in there and being like, oh, I wonder what she's doing on the show. And then knowing that she's going to have an episode later, you know, that Bella Abzug is going to have her own episode. You know, I think it's promising. I wish that Niecy Nash's character, yeah, that Flo Kennedy, it doesn't appear to me that she's going to get a standalone, but, maybe it'll happen in some other form. But, yeah, I think that, there's got to be a reason why all these big names signed on for this show. So I'm excited to see why as the series goes on.
Yeah, I think Niecy Nash is fantastic as Flo Kennedy, and I think if there's one thing I wanted more of in this series, it would be more of her and her character.
Yeah.
So we've got Flo Kennedy, a great civil rights leader and feminist, and then rounding it out, Tracy Ullman as Betty Friedan. Betty Friedan wrote The Feminist Mystique, 1963, and she is, you know, like, The Feminist Mystique is, like, hard, you know, even I, a Gen X or whatever, have read The Feminist Mystique. This is such an important piece of work. She was an absolute celebrity, as was Gloria Steinem, as the show sort of outlines for them. And one element of the Betty Friedan conversation, which is highlighted a bit more in episode 4, which is called Betty, is how she had a real journey to go through on the LGBT issue. And and the idea of including lesbian in the women's movement, which she was staunchly opposed to for a time. And so that's just part of this interior conflict that was happening in the women's movement. That question of intersectionality, the question of including, lesbian women. And I don't think it was even a conversation on the table to include trans women, but that is also something that obviously the feminist movement has struggled with, still has, struggles around. So, any thoughts on Betty Friedan and Tracy's performance there, Richard?
Oh, it's just always nice to see what Ullman, who is such a chameleon, you know, is doing. And I think Friedan is such an interesting character because she, like Steinem, as the sort of emblems of my understanding of second wave feminism, have in our third or fourth wave or wherever we are, at this point, been, you know, had a harsh light shine on them, you know? I think that what you find now in some ways is that, you know, women who are like, let's say, older Gen X, younger boomers, you know, kind of still look to Friedan and in particular, and by some younger people in the feminist movement now see those people as conservative, to some degree. So it's just an interesting, you know, like, how generationally these things evolve. So yeah, I'm excited for, more of Friedan because she's a fascinating figure, as they all are.
And then on the other side of the debate, obviously, we have Phyllis Schlafly as the queen. And then, like, these other figures are just much, you know, some of them not even real life figures, but it's basically like the Phyllis Schlafly show over on the other side of the debate here. And that in itself will become its own issue. But Cate Blanchett here doing a tour de force, wolfy performance as Phyllis Schlafly. And as you said, right off the bat, Richard, this is a character that could have been just a, you know, outright unsympathetic monster villain. And I'm not going to go so far as to say this show has given me like sympathy for Phyllis Schlafly, but it wants to give you nuance for who she
is. Well, understanding. I mean, she wasn't a sociopath, you know.
Right.
She, not that we shouldn't try to understand sociopaths, but you know what I mean? Like she had a complexity to her life as well. And, I think the show thus far has done a good job of acknowledging that. I think in particular, the scene with John Slattery, who plays her husband, where he basically forces her to have sex, which is something that she has said that there's no such thing as marital rape. And so I think it kind of addresses that from an angle that maybe people have not considered, that she herself, you know, had found herself in situations like that. So I don't know.
She's surrounded by this coterie of supporters. There's Sarah Paulson playing Alice McRae, who's a composite character, like a fictionalized character, but based loosely on Phyllis Schlafly's real life neighbor. There's the great Melanie Lynskey as Rosemary Thompson, who was a real life sort of leader of the Eagle Forum, this conservative group that Phyllis Schlafly founded. Jean Triplehorn playing Eleanor Schlafly, who is essentially like, I mean, she's, you know, this sort of put upon maiden aunt figure in the Schlafly household, but essentially serves the role of Phyllis's wife. Like if Phyllis becomes this like big political activist, you can't do all of that and like raise your kids. So essentially there's this other woman, not to mention, you know, maids in the house doing the mothering and the wifing while Phyllis Schlafly has carved out this other opportunity for herself, which I think is really fascinating. And lastly, but definitely not least, Kaylee Carter as this young woman named Pamela, who's an interesting participant and will have more to do later.
Yeah. Also, so here's the issue with a man being on this podcast. I wanted to briefly mention that, we see it. There is a scene where Phyllis's oldest son, John, asks one of, Phyllis's friend, like, oh, is he back from his tour? I asked Sarah Paulson's character, is your son back mm-hmm. from, I think, the war, essentially? And, he seems excited or very curious about that. And I think the interesting thing is that Phyllis Schlafly's eldest son, John, is a gay person. And, Schlafly was not a very pro-gay person. And, I'm wondering if that is going to come into the show, as the series goes on, because it's an interesting dynamic, you know, coming from very, you know, from within her own family.
It will. come into play. So, those are our cast of characters. We've got, you know, as you mentioned, John Slattery, we've got like some wives, some husbands and boyfriends that's come in and out and some other figures. We'll get to them more, but that's the main cast of characters. I just want to make sure that everyone is sort of like oriented in who we're talking about. Before we move on to sort of like some of the, you know, historical beats that we're going to be hitting in the series, let's take this opportunity to hear what Cate Blanchett has to say about the challenges of playing a character like Phyllis Schlafly. Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. Verging between the hysterical and, yeah, how are you?
That sounds about right. Somewhere between hysteria and like oddly normal, you know, just goes back and forth. So I just wanted to start sort of at the beginning with you and ask, you know, what it was about this project or Phyllis Schlafly specifically that got your attention in the first place.
Well, I'm always interested in surprising and unusual stories, particularly about pockets of history that one thinks one knows quite a bit about, as I did with second wave feminism. You know, I identified as a feminist when I was at high school, and whilst my mother was a feminist, she didn't identify with one, so it was kind of, that language was certainly in my upbringing. And to have suddenly be ambushed by a figure like Phyllis Schlafly, who has had such a profound influence on the notion of traditional womanhood as we understand it in our world today, but also in the rhetoric and the formation of the Republican Party as it exists today, but yet not to have known anything about her, I felt really ambushed by that. It was a perspective on the women's movement that I didn't know anything about. So, and obviously, someone who had spent their entire life working so tirelessly and passionately against the notion of equality, I wanted to know what was so threatening about it. So that was my starting point. I started with an audience member, I think, with a whole raft of questions that I wanted to ask Phyllis Schlafly, but unfortunately she died just after she endorsed Trump, which I also found fascinating.
Right.
Like, I thought, why was this 90-odd-year-old woman trucked out during Trump's campaign, and why was it that women voted that man in? And so there were so many contemporary questions that I wanted to ask, as well as questions about, what was the legacy of second wave feminism, and why did we seem to be having such similar conversations as women did back in the 70s? So there was, you know, there was, I came armed with a whole lot of questions, I guess.
So when you have questions like that for your process, when you're playing a real life character like this, you can't ask her directly. Where do you go for answers for those questions?
I went straight to the source. The Eagle Forum is one of the most deep pocketed archives that you could ever encounter. I mean, you go and look up Shirley Chisholm or Bella Abzug, and even Betty Friedan, and there's really not a great wellspring of interviews on radio and television and in written form that exist. But Phyllis's archives are enormous. So I went to her archives and obviously went to her authorized biography. So that was, it was in her own words that I went to, because Phyllis is such a polarizing figure. I mean, you know, to half the women in America, she's the Antichrist, and to the other, and a traitor to her sex, and the other half, she's a Joan of Arc figure. And so somewhere between those two things, I thought that there lied the woman. And so I went to her own words, actually, because I was wanting to delve into Phyllis's mindset in a non-judgmental way to find out what made her tick.
And something I love about this, the first episode of this season, is the creation of this movement that she leads seems to come out of the same frustrations, or at least similar frustrations, the same crucible almost that forms, you know, the staunch feminists of this series. These frustrations with being sidelined, having her ambitions frustrated, etc. And she's found a place where her voice can be heard. And that is a fascinating parallel to me.
Well, Darby talked about it a lot as being a David and Goliath story. And the hard thing for us to understand now, given that the Equal Rights Amendment still has not been ratified, even though 38 states have now, you know, ratified, but, you know, it seems unlikely, even though what's happened recently in Virginia, that it's going to be picked up and that the Constitution is going to be amended. But at the time that this was going on, that the women's movement was establishment, and Phyllis and those women that she identified and galvanized, the self-described traditional women, the homemakers who felt alienated and marginalized by the growing power and the groundswell of the women's liberation movement, that they felt like they were outsiders fighting a whole lot of insiders from their perspective, who had a lot of government money. You know, they were all heading towards this women's conference in Houston in 77, which, as Gloria Steinem said, is one of the most important events in American history that no one knows anything about. But they felt very much that they were on the outside, and Phyllis was an absolute master or mistress of the grassroots organizing. Right. And so she had through her newsletter and basically through, as we say in Australia, the Bush Telegraph, she mobilized this army of traditional women to fight what she, you know, and it was a lot of rhetoric of fear and that she employed, but she really did mobilize them to protect the family unit, because she sold this idea that feminists were anti-family. And, you know, and I think that that is something, that mud that Phyllis flung at the women's movement has kind of, in a way, stuck.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that we still have to justify to ourselves as women today, whether we're in the workforce or whether we're primarily in the home or whether we're trying to struggle, you know, with balancing both those things. But, all of those things that Phyllis instilled in her traditional women, I think that, you know, that dialogue and dialectic is still alive today. But there was it's so interesting you asked that question, because there is so much that when you look back at it now, you look at someone like Phyllis, who was a mother of six, who threw herself at the anti-ERA movement, the Stop ERA movement, and traveled all around America. And so was, even though she wasn't pulling in a wage, she was a working mother. But yet she was, you know, accused of flying around the country telling women to stay home.
All right.
So, she's the most sort of feminist woman who didn't identify as being a feminist. But I think it's because everything about her spoke to order, you know, from the way she presented her great love of tradition and hierarchy. You know, in her base ideology, she was not a feminist. She was not she was very happy being the only woman in the room, I guess, whereas that's the opposite of the whole feminist notion, is that you bring up other women behind you and beside you. Although, looking at the series, that doesn't always happen because of the political system. You know, there are always casualties, and sometimes it's the woman standing beside you.
That's one of the things I found incredibly powerful about, we're talking about these first three episodes that aired together. The two very personal injuries that Phyllis does to the women in her life, played by Sarah Paulson and Jean Triplehorn, I thought that was a really interesting way to bring maybe the larger injury she did to the women's movement down to a personal level. Can you talk about, you know, those two betrayals that exist in these episodes?
Well, it's interesting we talk about them as being betrayals. I think when a real life figure is presented, you know, whether it's Gloria Steinem or Phyllis Schlafly or Shirley Chisholm, you have to their lives are so complex, which is and interesting and contradictory, that's why you want to tell their stories in the first place. But there's so much life there that you have to select certain moments. So in a way, you're always driving people through the drama to the real life figure, but you are taking a perspective on the character. And so we look at these things as betrayals, whereas to Phyllis, it they weren't at all. I mean, we all, whether you're Phyllis Schlafly or, you know, or whoever, you do make missteps, and it doesn't mean that you're the Antichrist. It just means that that's what happened at the time. And I think what is interesting about Phyllis and reading about her is that a lot of people in her circles were absolutely in awe of her, of how she held it all together, how she was so involved and homeschooled her children, which she talked very proudly about in the phonics method. You know, and that's one thing, you know, I might diverge with Phyllis politically, but I agree with her that the phonics method is the way to teach children to read. You know, that she was full of these contradictions, but having six children and being so passionate about politics that she didn't have a lot of friends. And I think that that is probably the same for a lot of people who, women in particular, who throw themselves into the public sphere or into their work, but also they between that and their family, they don't have a lot of time for extraneous social interactions. Now, you can say that that's because she didn't value friendship, or you can say that she was just time poor. And so when you get time poor on a regular basis, you often neglect the injuries that that the pursuit of your passion, you know, the detritus, the flotsam and jetsam socially that goes on, you know, when you're as focused as Phyllis was. So what was it that she was, she had a disregard for people? I think that she had a profound belief that people had to take care of themselves, and that one of her, and so that includes people, you know, friends around, you know, so-called friends around her, is that, you know, if they didn't take responsibility for themselves, if they blamed their husband or blamed the government or, you know, blame the education system that they didn't get into Harvard, or, you know, if they'd worked harder, then they could have. And I think that that is a profound belief of Phyllis's, is that she did believe in individualism and exceptionalism, and she believed that she was exceptional, and that if she could do it, anyone could do it. And of course, the side of that which can never be looked at by her or the people close to her is that she's white. And she is attractive, and her mother gave her a great education and sacrificed everything to do so. But there are not everyone has a family as supportive as hers, or a husband as supportive as hers, or ends up in a socioeconomic environment, you know, a skin color as privileged as hers. So that there's perhaps because of her own experience, there's a sense that that she doesn't quite relate to people's experience other than outside her own, you know, and so therefore perhaps you could look at those things that went on in the series as betrayals in some way.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because, you know, there is this incident where Phyllis expresses distaste for racially charged language in her movement, and then on a dime almost sort of embraces these women because she needs them to build her coalition, which feels like a micro, you know, a microcosm version of the larger embrace of white supremacy or racist language or whatever that the conservative movement has taken on. And I'm curious, you know, does that have a foundation in the information you found on Phyllis, or is this a larger story you're trying to tell about the conservative movement?
Well, I think she's a like a smarter, more ideological, and definitely more polite version than Trump. Mm-hmm. In, you know, she's highly principled, and you know, I think that she always thought the women's right to choose what happened to their body, whether they have a family or don't have a family, or you know, that she always thought that that was a sin. You know, she was a staunch Catholic, but those religious overtones and her bringing together of so many disparate arms of the church was a first. But she did it very late in the day. She didn't come out of the bat with that language. She didn't see, I think it was probably Roe v. Wade, that she felt that the ground was being given over by the women's movement. So I think that what was interesting watching these various interviews that she gave and the books that she wrote, the foundational core was always about defence and the need for America to defend itself. And that her biggest fear, more than the feminists, was the communists.
Yeah.
And that she saw the feminists really as wanting to, you know, she was much more literal, I think, and didactic, perhaps, than the, you know, the feminists were dealing and walking into uncharted territory. So there were a lot of grey areas that they were entering into, and they were discovering loopholes and pockets of exclusion, you know, all the time, you know, whereas Phyllis, all she knew was that she didn't, that the communists, you know, and of course this is the American version of what actually went on behind the Iron Curtain, but she saw that the feminists were after a sex-neutral, totalitarian society where women were the same as men, and that they were going to be drafted into the military, you know, and the military might of the U.S. had already been, from her perspective, denuded. And so this was going to be a defense nightmare. And so she was, in the way, she took that whole rhetoric about the family needing to be defended. And she saw women as traditional women, but women generally, mothers, as being the guarders of society's morality, that they were stronger than men, which is, you think, would be a feminist perspective.
Right, right.
She thought they were stronger than men, more exceptional than men, and so therefore they had to protect the family, which was the foundation of American society, and that was always going to be eroded by the communists, and therefore the feminists were part of that communist plan. And so what she did, as much as, you know, as anything else, is she shifted the language around the anti-ERA movement to becoming, you know, she took the anti out of it and headed into the pro-family, pro-life and pro-American and sort of rhetoric. She shifted the brand. And what I found absolutely chilling, I think, ultimately, was the way that she placed this rhetoric, this polarizing rhetoric, in as a centralized bedrock part of the current Republican Party's brand, and that's, you know, that was a really, I think it was she did that obviously because she felt that, you know, all of those things were what the true Republicans needed to stand for, and she succeeded. Perhaps even more and more profoundly than stopping the ERA.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mention sort of being chilled by this aspect of her, because I know a challenge for a performer, or I should say, you know, an approach for most performers is, even if they're playing a villainous character, a character they don't agree with, you need to find a way in to empathy for that character. In terms of challenges you've had as an actor over the course of your career, identifying with or empathizing with a character, how much of a challenge does Phyllis present for you?
It was an incredible challenge. Mm-hmm. I think because she was probably, as much as she was front and center of the anti-ERA movement and gave more interviews than anyone, I think, in the history of American politics, she was probably quite shy, I think. And if you look back into her childhood, you know, being sent to a Catholic school, but her mother had to work 7 days a week. Her father was out of work for quite a number of years. So she was around a lot of very wealthy girls. She was always on the outside. And I think that she was always on the outside, ironically, of American politics, you know, yet she was so passionate about it. She was constantly sort of, as much as she inspired a whole generation of traditional women, she alienated so many people. So I think I sort of felt for her isolation, actually, in a lot of ways. And the, you know, I could see her incredible passion, but also I could see her Achilles heel, is that she sort of always made herself on the outside of a group. And so I, you know, and thinking, you know, she had two failed bids for Congress behind her.
Right.
And they must have sat with her. Someone who was prided herself on her successes, you know, the failure, I don't think sat well with Phyllis. And, but yet she didn't really talk about it. She just, you know, from her perspective, she just got on with it. She didn't blame anybody. But, you know, I think that I felt for that. And I think you have to find an empathy for the character, or an understanding, sort of a slightly uncomfortable understanding. It's like an analyst in a way. You have to sit them down and say, so why did you really do that?
Right.
You don't have to like them or dislike them. But I think when you're dealing with someone as polarizing as Phyllis, I don't think I've ever played somebody who, you know, you speak to one person and they passion. There's no one who had a kind of a mediocre, lukewarm response to Phyllis. They either loved her or hated her. Mm. And so that's a challenge, I think, you know, to sort of not, you know, obviously you had to serve the script and the story, and this isn't a story. It's not a biopic about Phyllis Schlafly. It would have been entirely different if it had. I wanted to be part of in a way, presenting the women's movement, warts and all, and the women's movement in all its complexity. So with the traditional women included, because often when we talk about second wave feminism or the women's movement, we you know, as Phyllis was always very quick to point out, that's the feminist women's movement. We're talking about the traditional women's movement or the mm-hmm. family women's movement, mm-hmm. you know. And so I felt for her. I felt for how outside everything she ultimately was, and how I think how much she wanted to be in the room.
You're an executive producer on this project, and that can mean different things to different actors to be an executive producer on their own project. What does it mean for you to be an executive producer on this project?
I mean, I spoke to Stacey Scherr and to Darby and John Landgraf right at the get-go, and Gina, and when Darby had this extraordinary sprawling idea, and so I wanted to be a part of it, and I've never been someone to option a book for me to play a role, or, you know, the role is always secondary to me. It's the subject matter, it's the directors. And when Ryan and Anna came on board as the initiating directors, I was super excited because I loved their work, and so that was really exciting. And so it's really to be part of it. And as the series unfolds, I think audiences will see that some, you know, there's a lot of points of connection. It's sort of what you were talking about before, you know, that there's a lot of commonality between what seems to be in the, you know, when it comes out of the gate, a group of very disparate, different women. Mm-hmm. That are coming up against the same sets of roadblocks and challenges, and same touchstones and inspirations, and so that's I want to be part of that. And obviously, all of the departments are equally important to me, both as an actor and as an executive producer. Who's going to shoot the thing? Because obviously, your relationship with the DP is really important, and how that's going to play out in the television landscape. You know, with when we started out, it was 6 episodes, then it was 8 episodes, then it was 9 episodes, because it was so much story.
Right.
You know, how many directors is that going to be? What, you know, who, you know, obviously because it's period, you know, we're so lucky to get Bina, you know, our extraordinary costume designer, and then obviously who's going to chief the hair and makeup, because that's a lot of women to get ready in the morning. So, you know, my interest was poetic as well as practical, you know. And then once the cast started to come on board, that's you know, at the end of the day, it's who you're working with. And so I was really, really excited by the cast that we were able to put together. But that's the material.
Yeah.
I think there are, even though we began talking about this before the election, the election in capitals,
mm-hmm.
it was a lot of a lot of these issues that were coming up in our everyday life, you know, over the last 4, 5, 6 years, I think all the actresses, I would hazard a guess, felt the same way, that you, when you went back to read the specifics again about these women that we're all going to play, it was literally like Groundhog Day. You thought, this is the same conversation that we're having. The culture wars that we're talking about now, they were, you know, emerging in the 1970s. And so it felt quite confounding and painful, but also really exciting to be doing something that seemed and I think is really, really relevant to us all.
Well,
right,
I mean,
now,
the fact that
not just women but to men,
right, and the fact that the ERA has still not been ratified is just sort of a staggering reality that looms over this whole series. You know,
but yeah, I know it's, but it's, there was a 2001 poll or survey, and 72% of Americans in 2001 already thought that the Constitution specified that citizens had equal rights regardless of gender. So, I didn't think it was an issue. And that's the thing about the time at which the series takes off in 1971, is it wasn't a party political issue. It was bipartisan. You know, this was going through, because what was so political about equality? You had the Equal Rights, you know, you'd had the Civil Rights Act of 64, and this was part of human evolution. It was part of American evolution. And all of a sudden, in stepped Phyllis and said, actually, this is a problem for our national identity and our sense of, and our national defense. And so it was the beginning of the closing of the borders. And so you first shut the picket fence, and then you build a wall. And so it's astonishing to me that it's, you know, that the notion of equality is has become politicized.
So, Richard, before we wrap up with our interview with the show's creator, Davi Waller, I wanted to go through some things that were happening at the time of that this show will be covering, just to have a sort of weather eye on it. And I think something that, you know, Davi will talk about in her interview, but I think this show does what both Halt and Catch Fire and Mad Men did so perfectly, which is put you in a place, a time and a place, in a way that doesn't at all feel surface, and makes everything that's happening around not feel dry or like a dog, but like real, a lot. Like, you feel the life of the 70s mm-hmm. around the story, the human story that's going on here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that something that good, you know, sort of recent-ish histories like this can do is, and it's both hopeful and discouraging in kind of equal measure, maybe, is remind you that, like, not a ton has changed, you know, in terms of how people spoke about things, what sort of, what the kind of feel of a political moment was. You know, obviously the particular circumstances are different, but, like, you know, all this kind of background stuff with Nixon that was going on is so similar to stuff that's going on now. And, I don't know. I think that in capturing the texture of the 70s so well, I mean, I wasn't alive then, but I can imagine, I think it just makes all of the issues of the story pop that much more.
Absolutely. And not just the stuff with Nixon, but the stuff, what the movement that Phyllis Schlafly herself builds is what creates a lot of what the conservative party is, the Republican Party is now. The way in which she, you know, there's this great moment, in the Gloria episode, I think it is, where she's on, Donahue, and, you know, she finishes talking there. She's just talking lies, about what the ERA would do. And Phil Donahue's like, did you fact check any of that stuff? And she's like, does it really matter though? You know, and it feels so Trumpy to me. And you know, and something that, you know, we should definitely note is that, Phyllis Schlafly, she died in 2016, but one of her last, you know, great efforts was to get Donald Trump elected. So this was like, this is who she is. So, okay. So we are starting the show in 1971. We are, you know, 1 year out. I mean, this is covered in some of the first three episodes, right? But we are in the midst of Nixon's reelection, where, to remind you, he won by the largest electoral landslide in American history. So, like, he just completely demolished George McGovern in this reelection.
My dad worked on the McGovern campaign from Massachusetts, where he was living and where I grew up. And he had a bumper sticker for a couple of years after Watergate that said, "Don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts." because it was the only state that Nixon didn't win that year.
Oh my God. All right. So 72, 73 is Watergate and Nixon's resignation. 73 is also when Roe v. Wade is decided. 1975 is when the Vietnam War ends, and we've got the Ford administration, the Carter administration will end with the election of Ronald Reagan. So that's sort of broad strokes, sort of where we are.
A long tumble through catastrophe to more catastrophe.
Yeah. But what's interesting is, you know, as I was sort of doing some light research into this decade, a lot of people position this as decade as marked by equally Watergate and the women's movement.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, that's what we are looking at here. And this idea that, you know, the ERA was that the feminists, the women who at least you and I, Richard, I think more identify with in this conversation, are on the losing side of this battle. And that is something to be aware of as we're looking at this. So we are looking at ultimately what is a failure for this big, you know, valiant effort on behalf of the feminists here. And so what I think the show does so well is examine both the triumphs, the emotional triumphs, and also what went wrong here. What did we miss? What did we do here? So.
Yeah, it was, and I think that, you know, hopefully in that way, it doesn't serve as just a kind of time capsule, you know, closed off period piece. It's galvanizing. Hope, you know, it's saying this fight is not over and there is still more to be done. You know, so I think that in that way, because it's a little bit, at least if you're on, you know, well, I guess on both sides, really open ended. The series can be a call to action, in addition to being a sort of, you know, period piece.
And I think the way in which each episode is somewhat centered on a different, figure, makes it, as you say, it's much more than, like ticking of the boxes or a dry tour through history or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen so many historical biopics or historical sort of coverage of a time just feel like, and then this happened and then this happened. And you're like, okay, I could just read the Wikipedia page. That's fine. But the human stories that are on display here on both sides of this argument, is what really elevates this for me. And I'm really excited for everyone else to see the rest of what they have, to show us here. So let us round out this episode with a conversation with series creator Dobbie Waller. I've been asking a lot of women that I know, in my life, when they think, the ERA was finally passed, and they keep like giving me dates, and I go, aha, trick, depressing question. It never was. but most people think it was. And so my first question for you is, you know, and when I continue those conversations, some of them are like, well, isn't, you know, the on the basis of sex, Supreme Court ruling, doesn't that make the ERA redundant, et cetera, et cetera? And I disagree, but I'm curious, you know, there are still efforts to get this passed. What do you feel like passing the ERA at this point or then? What is its impact? What are the stakes? What are we fighting for in this series, Mrs. America?
The Equal Rights, I did a lot of deep dive into the Equal Rights Amendment history, and it's like 100 years old. And I'm fascinated by the fact that it's had a resurgence in politics. You know, the Equal Rights Amendment would eradicate all discrimination in law that's on the books. what it wouldn't do, it wouldn't completely reverse, you know, 10,000 years of misogyny and mm-hmm. sexism in this country. It wouldn't remove sexism from the culture, from pop culture. And it wouldn't even apply, I believe, to private companies. It would only apply to public institutions, federal institutions. But I do think that would be a good thing, you know, if insurance companies couldn't charge different premiums for women than they do for men. I think that would be amazing, or any discriminatory practices like that. But more than that, I think the symbolic impact of having an amendment in the Constitution that says you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, and not having to fashion out of like a clause in the 14th Amendment, you know, lawsuits to end gender discrimination, I think would have the same impact as the First Amendment has. You know, it's not that the First Amendment protects your right to speak in a private company, you know, when you work for a private company like Amazon, but because it's in the Constitution, Americans feel like, you know, my First Amendment rights, I have a right to speak my mind. They just feel empowered to speak their mind because it's enshrined in the Constitution. And I think similarly, if the Equal Rights Amendment were in the Constitution, women would feel empowered that this is our God-given right to be treated the same as men. And I don't think we can discount the symbolic impact of it.
And what's interesting to me is that this project has been a development for a while, that it was written before, or large parts of it at least, were written before the 2016 election. And yet, yes.
Interesting to you, painful to me.
Oh, I'm sorry. how fascinating.
Very interesting. You spent 5 years on this project. Interesting.
How fascinating. No, but I'm more mean that a lot of the topics that you're covering here feel like things that we've been talking about even more so, you know, since the last election in recent years, especially as we're ramping up to this next election here in the U.S. And so, you know, my question for you is what got you interested in writing this particular project?
It's so funny. The producers and I joke that this is a series that keeps catching up to the zeitgeist, keeps catching up to the series in our world of politics. I grew up steeped in American politics, even though I grew up in Canada, because my dad's a political scientist and he taught American government at McGill. So I, you know, grew up loving any kind of film or television about politics. And I was looking to create a series that was a political drama, especially one that centered on women, because everything I had watched was the women were either the wives of the politicians or they were victims. I really wanted to create a series in which the women had agency and were seeking power for themselves. So when one of our producers pitched me the idea of centering a show on Phyllis Schlafly and her campaign against the Equal Rights Amendment, I just naturally sparked to it. I thought, oh, I think I can create something out of this. It's such a great jumping off point for a series about women in politics.
And as you sort of processed and broke out the series, when did you land on the idea of centering each episode on a different woman in the series?
Pretty early on, when I started looking at the two worlds, and I knew that there'd be these two worlds and they would intersect whenever there was a debate between Phyllis and one of the feminist leaders, or an interaction of some kind. So pretty early on, I saw that while there was only Phyllis on one side, she was the singular leader and there was no one else. There were so many feminist leaders. It was quite democratic. And I think, you know, Gloria Steinem would be the first to say there was not one leader of the women's movement. It was quite a large group. And I loved each and every one of them. They were all so fascinating and colorful and smart and funny and complicated. And I wanted each of them to have their due. And so I thought if I structured the series with sort of each episode rotating to be in the point of view of a different feminist leader, they would each get a chance to shine in their stories. And they each kind of told a different part of the story. It also allowed me to personalize this, you know, when you hear Equal Rights Amendment, like that just sounds like boring words strung together. And so I really wanted a way to sort of personalize this very abstract concept. And when you really go home with one of these characters and spend time with them and their point of view and with in their relationships and their family life and their friendships and their insecurities and desires and all that, it allows you to go deeper on the personal level. So I would say even when I was writing the pilot, I knew that each episode would change perspectives on the feminist side.
You mentioned that, you know, this the contrarian side really just has Phyllis as its leader. But then you've got this, of course, these other characters played by Melanie Lynskey, or this great composite character played by Sarah Paulson. Narratively, what does she provide for you in the show?
One of the reasons I was very drawn to telling the story partly from Phyllis Schlafly's point of view is I was really interested in all these homemakers who became so involved in her movement and really went from being full-time homemakers at home to becoming political activists and really becoming the foot soldiers in the Reagan Revolution in 1980. And there aren't that many, other than Rosemary Thompson, who's brilliantly played by Melanie Lynskey, there aren't that many public figures. So I spoke to a couple of women who were Schlafly Eagles, and I read a lot of whatever the blog version of 1970s were. I read articles in the newspaper, and out of that created this composite character of Alice and also the composite character of Pamela, played by Kaylee Carter. So, you know, one of the many women that Alice is based on is a neighbor of Phyllis Schlafly, who actually end up joining now. So it has quite an awakening. Yeah. It's all drawn from real people, but because they're all private citizens, you know, we wanted to create a fictional version and didn't want to use real names.
Right. You mentioned, you know, some of the resources. This is such a meticulously researched show. Every time I sort of go to look up something, I'm blown away by how much detail you've captured in this show that is absolutely historical. For you, you know, as a storyteller, how important is it to balance the history and the narrative? And then what are some of the best resources you were able to find for this project?
First and foremost, I never forgot that we're making a television show. So it has to be entertaining. This isn't a documentary.
Right.
This isn't a textbook you're reading. This has to be really entertaining. And that was always our goal. And so we really not only researched the events surrounding this epic battle, but also all the pop culture that was going on in the 70s. You know, the writers and I, we have mostly female writing staff, so it should be no surprise that we ended up with Pinterest-like posters in our hallway with cutouts of pop culture references from every year in 1970. It was amazing. It was, at the same time, to get that lived-in feeling, you really need to have it be, every detail be very historically accurate. If it feels like your research is very surface, it starts feeling very generic and very presentational, and it doesn't feel like you're literally just immersed. And so at every level of production, both in terms of the scripts and also production design and costumes and hair and makeup, we worked with some of the most talented people in the business. Being a day guard on costumes, and Mara Mapair-Sloop doing our production design, and Anne Morgan doing our wigs. So they all were steeped in research to really make sure that every single detail you're seeing on the screen is accurate to the period. As far as the resources that I found really helpful, this is going to sound pretty nerdy, but I became it also sounds like I'm shilling for newspapers.com, but this is an amazing resource for anyone writing a historical drama. You, for only like $80 a year, you can access any local newspaper, like over 1,800 local newspapers from any time period, I think going back to the 19th century. And the writers and I just spent hours and hours, and I remember spending days over the course of this development period, reading every article ever written about every woman in our series, every interview they did, every feature about them, every profile. If, you know, Flo and Gloria gave a speech in Ohio, I read that article and read what they said at the speech and how they were received. So that was an incredible resource, not only for the detail that you won't find in books written sort of 40 years later about the time period, but also because you can hear how the women are talking about the movement back then, not with hindsight. And you're hearing how they are referred to and how they are spoken about and what language they use. Radical commie liber, which is, you know, a favorite phrase among the Schlafly Eagles, you know, that's how they spoke about the women's movement at the time. So that was a great, incredible resource. And then I also want to say that these women on both sides were very prolific and wrote many, many memoirs. And sometimes I wish they had written like a few, maybe a little fewer memoirs. But we read, you know, all of them wrote books, and we read all their books. And like Bella Abzug wrote this really hilarious one-year diary of her first year in Congress that I hope to make very popular, called Ms. Abzug Goes to Washington. And it's so funny and amusing that her telling off, you know, President Nixon and the Speaker of the House, she's just so salty and fantastic, and played to perfection by Margot Martindale. So that was one of my favorite books to read.
There are moments of watching the show, you know, that I almost feel like I'm watching what happens for Peggy and Joan once they exit Mad Men, and Mad Men ends in 1970s. Joan mentions Betty Friedan at the end of the Mad Men final season.
That's right.
You know, and I'm like, do they, you know, and we just like walked into this next chapter in the story. How much, and I know you did great work on the 80s and 90s and Halt and Catch Fire as well in between, but like how much, you know, can we trace the Mad Men DNA in this project?
I would say a lot. I mean, I really talk a lot about the influence that working with Matt on Mad Men, all the writers on Mad Men, had on my career and the way I thought about storytelling, and particularly stories set in history. I definitely want to, by the end of my career, have hit every decade of the 20th century. I feel like four left to go. Absolutely. I mean, I learned so much from Matt, every detail. Like, I remember being on set for an episode that I was producing, and I think there was a secretary was doing a crossword puzzle, and Matt happened to come by set to visit, and he's like, why is she doing a crossword puzzle with a pen? She would never do a crossword puzzle with a pen. She would absolutely use a pencil. She doesn't have that kind of confidence. so we switched it out quickly for a pencil. And
something we definitely talk about when we think about the women's movement through the lens of 2020 is this idea of intersectionality and the way in which the second wave feminists were successful in that regard and the ways in which they weren't. And I think this series takes a really fantastic warts and all sort of look at what they got right and what they got wrong. How important was that for you for in this first three blocks to have, you know, the Shirley episode when you're painting this entire portrait of a movement?
It was critical. I mean, one of the very first things I said to the producers when I agreed to work on this project and bring it to life was I didn't want to do a story about the women's movement that excluded the birth of intersectional feminism. And even though when it came to the ERA debates, Phyllis only debated white feminists, and it was, you know, more way to use creative storytelling to really bring women of color into the story. I just felt it was critical. You can't tell the story of second wave feminists and leave that out. And I wanted to have Shirley's main episode early on in the series, and luckily her run for president, which is the period in time that we focused on in episode three, happened right around the time the Equal Rights Amendment passed through the Senate, like 3 months later. So it really worked out nicely, and we found thematic ways to link Shirley's story with the story of Phyllis in episode three.
I talked to Uzo already about it this week. She told me that
wasn't she amazing?
Yeah, she's incredible. But she was telling me that that Amma Asante is only the second woman of color to ever direct her in a film or TV show.
And, really?
Yeah, and how much that mattered to her. And I'm just wondering, you know, bringing Tanya on and Amma on to direct that episode, how much does that matter to you as a creator?
I think it is really important to allow people to tell their own stories. They're going to bring something to it that you couldn't possibly even imagine or have that perspective. And I wanted to have a diverse writing staff and have not just diverse by gender, by race, by sexual orientation, and by age. And we really did. We had everyone from in their 20s to in their late 60s, early 70s in our writer's room. And similarly with directors, we wanted to have a diverse group of directors. Tanya, early on, you know, we all did little reports on the different women in the series for the writer's room in the first week. And, you know, everyone just took someone who they were interested in going, diving deep into their biography and presenting it to the writer's room. Because as I said, there were so many books, I couldn't possibly all read them all. And Tanya really took an interest in Shirley's story. Tanya lives in Brooklyn, and she actually went back to look at Shirley's papers when she was back home.
And one of the things that I really, you know, we already touched on this a little bit. One of the things I really enjoy about this series and enjoyed about Mad Men and enjoyed about Desperate Housewives and enjoyed about Halt and Catch Fire is this idea of watching women in conflict, but still being expected as an audience to be on the side of both women. And I know that sounds maybe a little silly because obviously we let men be in conflict and be on both sides of the conflict all the time as audiences. But I feel like it's a little rare to see it with women. I remember, you know, the first time that Joan and Peggy have conflict on Mad Men, I sort of gasped and I was like, what? You can't have the two women would not be at odds with each other.
They've got to be in this together.
Right, exactly. So I'm wondering, what are the narrative fruits of putting, you know, women that we care about in conflict with each other in a story?
I think you brought up such a great point, which is we show men in conflict all the time, and it's just called conflict. But anytime women come into conflict, and we're like, oh my God, it's a catfight.
Right.
And so I wanted to have more women in conflict on television to actually normalize it, because the more, you know, why aren't women allowed to be represented in all the diverse ways men are allowed to be represented? And the more we put it out there, the more normal it'll feel. And we'll stop gasping and just see it for what it is, which is, you know, women, there is no monolith in terms of sisterhood or how, or ideas about women or what women should do or how they should behave. And to have women, you know, arguing passionately for things that are important to them is exciting to watch. And so I didn't want to shy away from that at all. And I remember being kind of disheartened when early on an executive referred to a scene in episode 2 where all the women are arguing about what to do about this Phyllis Schlafly problem. And he said, it just sounds like a bunch of women squabbling. And I was so disheartened to hear that, because these women are brilliant, successful women. Two of them are congresswomen, and they're arguing about something that really matters, and to reduce it to squabbling or to even to hear it as squabbling made me sad. And so my hope is that the more we allow women to be messy, to have conflict, the more normal it'll feel, and we'll stop thinking of it as a catfight and just see them the same way we would view men in conflict.
Yeah, and in the interest of that, I think the way in which Phyllis is introduced in the series and treated throughout the series as someone who is, you know, the villain of the piece for sure, but also someone that we can have some empathy for, or at least some interest in the emotional place that she's coming from, or the, you know, the fact that her fight is sort of cooked out of the same crucible that fights, that spurs these other women to fight, you know, which is the various indignities and slights and even worse that she endures. And so, you know, I was talking to Kate Blanchett about this, about how difficult was it for her to access Phyllis, from a place of sympathy. That's obviously the actor's challenge. You have to sympathize with whoever you're playing. How challenging it was for her. And she laughed. She's like, extremely.
I feel that. Yeah. It's challenging to write.
Yeah. That's my question. Is it, you know, like, you know, as you're crafting, particularly this first episode, which is so, you know, trying to find an emotional way into this woman and all these sort of crime she committed against her own sex, like, you know, how do you get there as a writer?
Really try to access the, you know, we all have children in us who are in some ways wounded or have whatever experiences we had in childhood that we carry with us as adults and behave in certain ways because of our childhood. If I can find the child in them who's yearning for order or peace or whatever it is they yearn for, or acceptance, sometimes that allows me to access them in a way through empathy. And then you really have to work at removing judgment while you're writing them, which is not to say you don't have a point of view about them, but there's that fine line you're constantly walking where you want to write them as authentically as you can, without bringing myself into it. It's hard. I'm not going to lie. It's much easier to write some of the other. I'm not going to sit here and be like, I didn't bang my head against the wall. And it's particularly hard because I was writing the draft of the pilot in November 2016. Yeah. That's particularly difficult. Yeah. Yeah. In my white outfit that I voted in. But to render her two-dimensional doesn't really allow us to understand her, and if we don't understand her, then we don't understand how backlash movements operate, and if we don't understand that, I think that we're doing a disservice for ourselves.
Yeah. And my last question for you, and not to ask such a nakedly, like, sort of typically female question after we've talked about let's not put women in one corner, but I personally got emotional watching a lot of this series, both for the way in which we haven't moved on from some of these conversations yet, and the small moments or big moments of triumph that these women do experience in this series. Was there anything that was particularly emotional or personal feeling for you to either write or see the finished version of?
I don't think you're putting baby in a corner by asking quote one of my favorite movies. Uh-huh. What was very emotional for me was reading how the feminists wrote about where they thought they'd be in 76. They really believe, you know, we might not get there in 72, but we're definitely going to have a woman president by 76 or 1980 at the latest. And 50% of Congress will be female by 1980. And I got really emotional reading that. And so when we shot the scene where Shirley is up on stage at the end, this woman in multicolor dress among a sea of white male gray suits, I got very emotional thinking that 45 years later, we still don't have a female president. And then the other time I got very emotional was when we were filming on the convention. Convention floor is making me emotional, is what I'm realizing as I answer this question. filming on the convention floor in episode 8. And if you Google the videos from this convention, I start crying just watching the archival footage of it. I felt that was really, Gloria Steinem refers to the convention as the most important 4 days that no one ever talks about anymore. And it really seemed to be a moment where women really came together and reached consensus about ways to move forward. And this was the first time they included gay rights in their platform and intersectionalism. This was when women of color as a term was coined back in 77. And the feeling on the floor with almost entirely women arm in arm really made me very emotional and gave me hope that, you know, there is... sisterhood can be powerful if we marshal it and harness it in the right way. And if we maybe are a little more flexible about what we accept in other women, and that we all have a different pace for getting there.
Absolutely. Those are two places I also cry, but not the only places I cried while watching this show. So thank you. Thank you, Dobby, so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Joanna. It's so great to talk to you.
I appreciate it. All right, Richard, that does it for us this week. We will be back next week with the episode Betty and an interview with Rose Byrne. Until then, where can folks find you, Richard Lawson?
I'm going to be partying at a gala at the Guggenheim Museum with, Gloria and all my other friends. All my cool Andy's going to be there. Can't wait. No, I'm kidding. I'm going to be home. Like, I've been home. Like, everyone should be home. I'm just home. And I'm tweeting at Rylaws and writing stuff for VF.com. Where will you be until next week?
I'll be tweeting at Joe Wrote This. I'll be writing at VF.com. But most importantly, I, like Phyllis Schlafly and all of her many women, will be making bread. That is the thing we do now. We make bread from the bread makers to the bread winners. We bring you this podcast, and we will see you next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.